that we will always be supported and we are all united in the face of this aggression.
In their speeches, Palestinian factions stressed that the issue of a Nakab is the issue of every Palestinian and they won't sit idle in the face of these illegal crimes.
This event is organized by the national and the Islamic forces in Gaza and all the Palestinian tribesmen in order to express our support to our people in Al-Nakab, who are under the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. Israel wants to expel those people from their lands and homes, and this is unacceptable for us. We are together until breaking the Zionist Bennett, who threatened to build an iron wall around our people in Al-Nakab.
Calling it an ongoing Nakba, hundreds of Palestinian citizens demonstrated in Al-Nakab, while dozens of them were arrested by the Israeli regime. The number of Arab citizens in Al-Nakab is estimated at 300,000, living on 5% of the land, of which they said that Israel had confiscated 95% since 1948. Al-Nakab has seen a dramatic escalation as the Israeli regime intensifies its apartheid policies of seizing the Palestinian lands. Palestinians here stress that Al-Nakab is not alone in this struggle. They also say they won't remain silent in this battle against the Israeli crimes. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Mattarella. Mattarella.
After 6 days of failed votes and 8 rounds of ballots, on Saturday the Italian parliament re-elected 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella as president of the republic with 759 votes out of 983 cast by the grand electors. In the days ahead of the election, Mattarella, who has been in office since 2015, had repeatedly said that he didn't want another stint. However, he changed his mind on Saturday afternoon when the leaders of parliamentary groups resorted to him in a desperate attempt to put an end to a political impasse that would erode the nation's credibility. The political stalemate was triggered by parties' disagreement over the candidacy of Prime Minister Draghi to be the next president earlier in the week. In the following days, parties struggled to reach an agreement over an alternative figure, dragging the country on the verge of a political crisis. Commentators have slammed political leaders for their bickering over a consensus candidate. Some have said that not even during a pandemic crisis which has brought the country to its knees, political parties have been able to put aside their differences. Prime Minister Draghi is expected to reshuffle his cabinet as his first move following Mattarella's election. He has to make sure that the 260 billion euros that Italy is receiving from the European Recovery Fund to counter the economic fallout of the COVID-19 crisis are spent effectively. Draghi has committed to 58 reforms and 132 investments over the next 5 years. Max Civili, Rome.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kiswe town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There's an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow, the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in in solidarity with Palestinians in the Negev. The event was held in the east of Gaza by Palestinian resistance factions. In recent days, the Israeli regime launched violent attacks in the Negev to evict Palestinians from their villages. Palestinians view Israeli attacks in the Negev as a continuation of the 1948 Nakba, when Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their homes during the creation of the Israeli regime.
This criminal entity will never succeed in stealing our land. Destroying the villages will not break the will of our people in the Negev. As we stand here, we say to the enemy that we will defend the Negev, like we defend all Palestinian lands.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians in the Negev suffer from continuous displacement attempts in order to uproot them from their land and homes. Every year, hundreds of Bedouin homes are razed to the ground as part of the Israeli regime's settlement expansion projects in the Negev. Hamas has called for unity among all Palestinians to fight Tel Aviv's expansionist policies.
We stand in solidarity with our brothers in the Negev who are being subjected to ethnic cleansing and apartheid. The Israeli regime is a racist regime, and we will not sit idle as it attacks our people in the Negev. By attending this event, we are sending a message of unity to all Palestinians against the crimes of the Israeli regime.
The Islamic Jihad movement accused Arab regimes who normalized ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against Palestinians.
Normalization by some Arab regimes has given the Zionist enemy the green light to commit crimes against Palestinians in the Negev. Those who normalize ties with our enemy are giving legitimacy to the Zionist enemy. The Zionist enemy is a criminal and racist regime and will defend the Negev.
Palestinians have also condemned the international community's silence on Israeli crimes in the Negev.
People here vow to stand by Palestinians in the Negev who have been subjected to ethnic cleansing by the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
After the Friday prayers, people gathered to protest against Saudi Arabia's ongoing war on Yemen, demanding Prime Minister Imran Khan to use his influence to stop the Saudi war on Yemen.
Yemenis' chants are down with USA, down with Israel, and down with Al Saud. They're the best Muslims who are fighting with Israel and other U.S. allies, sacrificing their children and loved ones. Those killing Yemenis are arranging anti-Islamic concerts in the Holy Land in the name of modernity and even banned recently an Islamic preaching groups from India and Pakistan.
Yemen is facing an unequal war for more than 7 years now. The war has claimed tens of thousands of lives, many of them women and children.
Recently, we are witness that the Yemeni people are more than Palestinian and Kashmiris are oppressed. So it is our duty as a Pakistani, I feel that it's our obligatory duty to stand with the oppressed people of Yemen and to condemn all of the oppressors, including United States, European governments and their puppets, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and other allies.
Rights groups say while countries continue to turn a blind eye, there will be no end in sight to this horrendous conflict that has seen immeasurable suffering inflicted upon the men, women and children of Yemen. Yemenis have been knocking on all doors demanding accountability and justice. Member states owe it to them to take this forward at pace. The welfare of millions is in their hands. Protesters are outraged at the ongoing Saudi atrocities in Yemen. They are calling on the international community to take immediate actions and end the bloodshed. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson coming out fighting this week. not the contrite, apologetic prime minister a week earlier over Partygate, allegations of rule-breaking parties under his roof during lockdown last year.
Even though these things are quite damaging, none of them constitute an artillery shell into his bunker. So that's why Boris is still alive and peddling his pipe.
Boris Johnson's list of problems have grown bigger in recent weeks as more images and allegations of illegal parties at his residence emerged. The result, an official inquiry and a police investigation, the former by senior civil servant Sue Gray. The outcome of those investigations are yet to be published, but the scandal is taking its toll. Apart from the opposition, some members of the Prime Minister's own Conservative Party have called for his head. Others say they're waiting on the Sue Gray report.
Well, of course, we all want to know the story, warts and all, but the police are saying that it would prejudice a police investigation. And much as we don't like that, nobody's going to be able to stop them taking the line that they choose to take. What I fully expect is that the Sue Gray report will reveal more of the same sort of antics.
While some MPs in the Prime Minister's Conservative Party sit on the fence, the Court of Public Opinion has already come up with a verdict.
If he's found to be guilty of these things, then I guess he's got to go.
He should quit. Very hypocritical from start to finish.
Just admit it and just say it happens.
He should resign.
That has meant plunging popularity ratings, a 32-point lead for Labour, meaning some Conservative MPs would face a near wipeout if a general election were to be held now. Add to that a cost-of-living crisis and fresh accusations of corruption over the funding of his Downing Street flat refurbishment.
It's hardly the first time Boris Johnson is having to wriggle through controversies, but the odds are very different this time. If he is found to have misled Parliament about those parties, he will be in breach of the so-called ministerial code. Saeed Puriza, London.
North Korea Thursday conducted a round of ballistic missiles testing, firing two short-range rockets off its east coast. Analysts suggest North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants to show his people he's their defender, although the tests have several purposes.
They're trying to make a point regarding the South Korean presidential election. They're trying, I think, to try to intimidate South Koreans into thinking, look, you've got to come to terms with us, the North Koreans.
Since late 2017, North Korea has not conducted a long-range missile test or a nuclear test in the hopes of making a deal with former U.S. President Donald Trump on sanctions relief. No deal has materialized. And leader Kim has recently indicated the moratorium on long-range missile testing and nuclear testing has expired.
He said that he might want to go beyond simply testing missiles, implying, not saying directly, but implying that he might want to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, that's capable of carrying a warhead to the United States. And he might even want to have another underground nuclear test.
The U.S. has criticized the recent testing, while China places the blame for tensions on the U.S. reliance on sanctions on North Korea. South Koreans will head to the polls to elect a new president on March 9th. With North Korea conducting six rounds of missile tests in just the past month, security, military affairs, and relations between Seoul and Pyongyang are likely to figure heavily in that election. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Shias in Italy, The Path of Minor Islam in Diaspora, is the title of a recent book which illustrates the role, practices, and ethnic composition of the Shia communities of Italy. The author is the Iranian expat and Palermo-based Minu Mishahwalad, an established academic researcher with a vast portfolio of publications on Islamic law and Iran's history. Mirshah Balad's work was carried out in the span of 3 years in 13 different Italian cities, mostly in the north of Italy, where the bulk of the Shia communities reside.
A large number of Shias have moved to Italy's wealthy north for work-related reasons. According to rough estimations, they make up about 5 to 10% of the 2.5 million Muslims residing in Italy. The majority of them are from Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, and Lebanon. And then we have the Italians who have converted to Shia Islam.
Immigrants from Pakistan and the Indian subcontinent are very active in social events and religious rituals, such as the large Ashura ceremony in front of the Milan Central Station. However, also political activism is widespread, particularly among Shias living in Rome, with events organized in solidarity with the assassinated top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
To our Shias generally organize more events and commemorations compared to Sunni Muslims residing in Italy. Another important aspect of my research shows how among the Shia faithfuls are today also a growing number of Italians. They have found in the Shia Islam a spiritual and political place where they can stand against the U.S. and Israelis' hegemony, where their traditional family values and love for artistic expression are welcomed.
About 2.5 million Muslims are living in Italy, making Islam the country's second largest religion. However, unlike Christianity and Judaism, Islam isn't formally recognized, meaning that mosques cannot receive public financing support, Islamic marriages have no legal force, and Muslim workers aren't entitled to take days off for religious festivities. Mircea Khvalad's research book also examines how Shia religious leaders in Italy interact with Shia religious authorities in a diasporic context. Max Civili, Rome.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or UN mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S. Daesh cooperation in Syria.
The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions, and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure. It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Protests against a highly divisive bill have intensified in London as debates rage inside Westminster. The Nationality and Borders Bill has several controversial clauses which minority groups have accused of being racist and turning black and brown Brits into second-class citizens.
The fight over this clause is far from over. It remains in the House of Lords, who are debating the various controversial clauses which remain as part of this wide bill. Now, there is a lot of division to various clauses, and if the Lords decide that they want amendments to it, it will bounce back to Parliament.
The bill seeks to provide the Home Office with additional powers to revoke citizens' nationality status and deny access to refugees fleeing to Britain.
I'd like to make
The government have offered reassurances, with Home Secretary Priti Patel claiming the law would be used only in exceptional circumstances on people who pose the most risk to the UK. But critics find it hard to trust Number 10.
Trust is something that needs to be earned. It's not a right for the government to assume that they're going to have trust from its citizens, especially when they're putting something in which is so vague that it leaves too many interpretations open.
Priti Patel is actually quite a disgrace to her ancestors. As a migrant, she knows that she came from the backs of those who were colonized by the system. And now you create a bill to oppress those? I think that's pretty fascist for me. And just because she's got a little bit of power, she's forgotten who she's made from, where she comes from. And just because she sits with some people with privilege, I'm using my privilege to use it to create a change for other people. What is she doing?
Having been passed by MPs in the House of Commons last December, the bill is now going through the House of Lords, where peers are suggesting amendments. The bill likely won't become law for the next few months, leaving plenty of time for further protests. Robert Carter, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
The regimes that cry that they kill innocents by accident or unintentionally or because the terrorist shield behind them are also the ones that keep killing innocents, says Jonathan Cook, writer in an article titled Honest Mistakes: How U.S. and Israeli Regime Justify Targeting and Killing Civilians. Stay tuned for more. Supposedly independent Pentagon inquiry this month claimed just such a good faith mistake after U.S. commanders authorized a drone strike in late August that killed an Afghan family, including seven children. A U.S. Air Force general concluded that there was no negligence or misconduct and that no disciplinary action should be taken. At the weekend, the Pentagon exonerated itself again. It called the 2019 airstrike on Baghouz in Syria that killed dozens of women and children justified. It did so even after an investigation by the New York Times showed that the group of civilians who were bombed had already been identified as fleeing fighting between U.S.-backed militias and Daesh. A U.S. military lawyer, Dean Corsack, flagged the incident at the time as a potential war crime, but the Pentagon never carried out an investigation. It came to public attention only because Corsack sent details to a Senate Oversight Committee. In announcing the conclusions of its Afghanistan inquiry, the Pentagon made clear what its true priorities are in the wake of its horrid Saigon-style exit from Afghanistan following two decades of failed occupation. It cares about image management, not accountability. Contrast its refusal to take action against the drone operators and commanders who fired on a civilian vehicle with the Pentagon's immediate crackdown on one of its troops who criticized the handling of the withdrawal. Veteran Marine Stuart Scheller was court-martialed last month after he used social media to publicly berate his bosses. Which of the two, Scheller's comment or the impunity of those who killed an innocent family, is likely to do more to discredit the role of the U.S. military in Afghanistan or other theaters around the globe in which it operates? Pentagon is far from alone in expecting to be exempt from scrutiny for its war crimes. The honest mistake is a continuing colonial narrative Western nations tell themselves and the rest of us when they kill civilians. When Western troops invade and occupy other people's lands and maybe help themselves to some of their resources, they find along the way it is done in the name of bringing security or spreading democracy. You're always the good guys, they are the evil ones. We make mistakes, they commit crimes. This is self-righteousness, is the source of Western indignation at any suggestion that the International Criminal Court at The Hague should investigate, let alone prosecute U.S., European, and Israeli regime commanders or politicians for carrying out or overseeing war crimes. The drone operators who killed the family of Zimari Ahmadi, an employee of a U.S. aid organization, were authorized to do so because his white Toyota Corolla was mistaken for a similar vehicle reported as belonging to the local franchise of Daesh. But that make is one of the most common vehicles in Afghanistan. The head of the aid organization where he worked told reporters pointedly, "I do not understand how the most powerful military in the world could follow Mr. Ahmadi, an aid worker, in a commonly used car for 8 hours and not figure out who he was and why he was at a U.S. aid organization's headquarters." The decision was at best recklessly indifferent as to whether Ahmadi was a genuine target and whether children would die as a result. But more likely, when it attacked Ahmadi's vehicle, the entire U.S. military system was in the grip of a blinding thirst for revenge. 3 days earlier, 13 American troops and 169 Afghan civilians had been killed when a bomb exploded close to Kabul airport as Afghans master in the hope of gaining a place on one of the last evacuation flights. The airport explosion was the final military humiliation, this one inflicted by Daesh, after the Taliban effectively chased American troops out of Afghanistan. Revenge, even when it is dressed up as restoring deterrence or military honor, is not an honest mistake. But there is an even deeper reason to be skeptical of the Pentagon inquiry. There is no honest mistake defense when the same mistakes keep happening. Honest mistakes can't be a pattern of behavior. And yet the long years of U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq and meddling in Syria have been pockmarked with airstrikes that obliterated families or slammed into wedding parties. That information rarely makes headlines, eclipsed by the Pentagon's earlier faulty claims of successful neutralization of terrorists. But just such mistakes were the reason why the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan ultimately imploded. The Pentagon's scattergun killing of Afghans created so many enemies among the local population that U.S.-backed local rulers lost all legitimacy. Something similar happened during the U.S. and U.K.'s occupation of Iraq. Anyone who believes the Pentagon commits honest mistakes when it kills civilians needs to watch the video Collateral Murder issued by WikiLeaks in 2012. It shows the aerial view of helicopter pilots in 2007 as they discuss with a mix of technical indifference and gruesome glee their missile strikes on a crowd of Iraqis, including two Reuters journalists moving about on the streets of Baghdad below. When a passing van tries to come to the aid of one of the wounded, the pilots fire again, even though a child is visible in the front seat. In fact, two children were found inside the van. U.S. troops arriving at the scene made the decision to deny both treatment from U.S. physicians. As the pilots were told of the casualties, one commented, "Well, it's their fault for bringing their kids into a battle." The other responded, "That's right." Before the video was leaked, the military claimed that civilians killed that day had been caught in the crossfire of a gun battle. There is no question that coalition forces were clearly engaged in combat operations against a hostile force, a statement read. The video, however, shows that there was nothing honest or mistaken about the way those Iraqis died, even if there was no specific intention to kill civilians. They were killed because U.S. commanders were uninterested in the safety of those it occupied, because they were indifferent to whether Iraqis, even Iraqi children, lived or died. The regimes that cry loudest that they kill innocents by accident or unintentionally or because the terrorist shield behind them are also the ones that keep killing innocents. The Israeli regime's version of this is the tragic mistake. The excuse is used in 2014 when its navy fired two precision missiles at a beach in Gaza at exactly the spot where four boys were playing football. They were killed instantly. In 7 weeks of pummeling Gaza in 2014, the Israeli regime killed more than 500 Palestinian children and more than 850 adult civilians. And yet all were apparently honest mistakes, because no troops, commanders, or politicians were ever held to account for those deaths. Palestinian civilians keep dying year after year, decade after decade, and yet they are always killed by an honest mistake. The Israeli regime's excuses are entirely unconvincing for the same reason the Pentagon's carry no weight. Both have committed their crimes in another people's territory to which they have not been invited. Both militaries rule over those people without good cause, treating the local population as hostiles, and both act in knowledge that their troops enjoy absolute impunity. In reaching its decision on the killing of the Afghan family this month, the Pentagon stated that it had not broken the law. That verdict, too, is not honest. What the U.S. military means is that it did not break its own self-serving rules of engagement, rules that permit anything the U.S. military decides it wants to do. It behaves as if no law applies to it when it invades other lands, not even the laws of territories it occupies. That argument is dishonest, too. There are the laws of war and the laws of occupation. There is international law. The U.S. has broken those laws over and over again in Afghanistan and Iraq, as has the Zionist regime, in ruling over the Palestinians for more than five decades and blockading parts of their territory. The problem is that there is no appetite to enforce international law against the planet's sole military superpower and its allies. Instead, it is allowed to claim the role of benevolent global policeman. U.S. and the Israeli regime declined to ratify the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court, ICC, that judges war crimes. That refusal was no honest mistake either. Each expected to avoid the court's scrutiny. U.S. and Israeli regime leaders know their troops commit war crimes, and that they themselves commit war crimes by approving either the wars of aggression these troops are expected to wage or the messy, long-term, belligerent occupations they are supposed to enforce. But whatever they hope, the failure to ratify the statute does not serve as a stay-out-of-jail card. U.S. and Israeli regime leaders still risk falling under the ICC's jurisdiction if the countries they invade or occupy have ratified the statute, as is the case with Afghanistan and Palestine. The catch is that the Hague Court can be used only as a last resort. In other words, it has to be shown first that any country accused of war crimes failed to seriously investigate those crimes itself. The chorus from the U.S. and Israeli regime of honest mistake every time they kill civilians is just such proof. It demonstrates that the U.S. and Israeli regime systems are entirely incapable of upholding laws of war or holding their own political and military officials to account. That must be the job of ICC instead. But the court is fearful. The Trump administration launched a war against it last year to stop its officials investigating U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. The assets of the court's officials were blocked and they were denied the right to enter the U.S. That is the reason why the court keeps failing to stand up for the victims of Western war crimes like Zimari Ahmadi and his children. The ICC had spent 15 years dragging its feet before it finally announced last year that it would investigate allegations of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. That resolve quickly dissolved under the subsequent campaign of pressure. In September, shortly after Ahmadi's family was killed by U.S. drone operators, the court's chief prosecutor declared that investigations into U.S. actions in Afghanistan, including widespread claims of torture of Afghans, would be deprioritized. The investigation would focus instead on Taliban and Daesh. Once again, enemies of the United States, but not the United States itself, will be called to account. That, too, is no honest mistake.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Sister Asma, would you like to do the choo-choo-ka-choo?
No, that's yours.
All right, just me, yeah? Choo-choo-ka-choo, it's the Youth Station for you. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider.
Hello, everyone, dear listeners, and this is Asma.
What are we talking about today?
Well, the very favorite subject of humankind, mistakes.
Mistakes. Okay, yes. Mistakes. What about mistakes?
Why do we do mistakes?
Because we're stupid. You want to know the truth? It's just because we are unintellectual. Allah gave us an intellect and
we're unexperienced. Let's put it this way.
Unexperienced?
Yes.
No, I don't think so. I think the human race has had plenty of experience and lots of history to learn from.
Still, we do not know anything. We're unexperienced.
That's true, but we know enough not to make mistakes.
But so because you're a human being, then you are sometimes tested with those mistakes that you do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you decide to do that mistake, but it also is a part of your testing process.
Hold on a moment. When we're saying mistake, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about sins or like just slip-ups that you couldn't avoid? Like, because there's a difference between ithm and dhanb
in Arabic in the Quran, right?
Yes,
Dhanb is kind of a mistake that you couldn't avoid.
Yes.
Ithm is actually a sin. So what are we talking about here?
Both, maybe.
Both, maybe? Okay.
Yes. We could talk about both, because both can happen to everyone. Either sin or just a little mistake you do, a slip of a tongue,
mm-hmm.
something you don't mean it, but it happens.
Uh-huh. Let's say that somebody insults somebody by accident.
Yes.
If they didn't mean to insult somebody, is it still an insult?
Still an insult, but if you think about it and you become conscious of the wrong that you have done, maybe that is forgettable. Forgivable, maybe. Don't you think so?
Oh, yeah.
There's always a chance for you to
I don't know,
repent.
I feel like it always comes down to the intention. I remember two of my friends once had a fight, and you know, he was like, no, he's saying this. And I was like, yeah, but look at why he's saying it. He's not saying it to attack you or to defame you or anything. He's saying it because he doesn't want Islam to be violated. You know, he doesn't want this sin to take place.
Yes.
And that's, even if you disagree with what he's saying, the reason for why he's saying it is actually quite noble and respectable. So for that case, you know, forgive him.
Yes, and sometimes, some other times, you are really in a bad mood, or you are in a bad temper, then something happens to you, you say something, you really don't mean it, but then just after some moments, perhaps some seconds, you feel that you've done something wrong, and then you ask the pardon of that person.
Okay, so now we've narrowed this
God
discussion down.
God is very forgivable.
God is forgiving, but
He's
people
merciful.
Aren't.
Okay, then you ask their mercy.
Yeah, okay, look, Allah is such, right, that there's a hadith that says that one who commits a sin, and then that very moment they repent,
yes,
it's as if they never committed that sin at all.
That's okay.
So, you know,
that's what
and
I'm
by
talking
repentance,
about.
It actually specifies that they become, you know, very, very embarrassed by that sin, and then they don't do it again, right? That
yes.
that is forgiven almost.
You should
actually
pay for it.
Okay, but then when you do that to a person, that person might not forgive you.
If you ask their mercy, why not? If you ask them to excuse you. They would do, because they're human. They might do that too.
You've had some good experiences with people.
Yes, I am.
Alhamdulillah. Okay, so that's insulting people. What about other mistakes? Sometimes when you make a mistake,
yes.
You know, it makes you repentant, you know, whether it's a sin or whether it's actually just another kind of mistake, you become
Oh, what about the bad decisions you make to yourself? I mean, the mistakes you do to your own self. Sometimes we do things that would hurt nobody except us.
Mm.
What about those times? Is it still a sin?
It is still a sin, yeah. A sin is a sin, like whether it's affecting other people or not.
However you put it, it's a sin.
Yeah. It's like, it's one of the most selfish ways to actually think. People think, oh, I'm only harming myself. But actually, no, you're not. Sins will inevitably hurt everybody around you. And the most obvious example of that is suicide, right?
Yes.
Suicide,
yes.
People think, okay, yeah, I'm only harming myself, therefore I have the right to do it. And they don't even give a thought about their mother or their wife
parents,
or their husband,
yes,
you know, their parents
and
their
every
siblings.
Single person who
All
they
the
are
friends
responsible
who
for.
Knew them, you know. That's why when somebody approaches somebody who's about to commit suicide, they tell them, think about your friends. What is your mom going to say? What
exactly
is your,
about their feelings.
You know, what are your children going to think? You know, you're going to break their hearts and,
yes.
you know, those kind of things. That's an extreme example, and it's an obvious example,
mm-hmm.
but other sins also, like, for example, listening to music. I'm listening to haram music because there's lots of halal music, alhamdulillah.
Yeah.
Lots of halal alternatives to ghina. Ghina is actually the haram music.
Yes.
But you're listening to it, you're like, I'm only harming myself. Oh, you know, if Allah's going to punish me, it's only going to be me. I'm not harming. Actually, no, you're still
alone.
Harming other people.
Yes.
You just don't realize the psychological effects that it's
exactly.
had on you. And because of those psychological effects, you know, you're going to have an impact on your friends and
family. Yes, based on that music, maybe you get depressed, and that depression is going to affect other people around you.
Drugs,
so there is
same
no
thing.
Personal
right, yeah.
sin.
Yeah, yeah.
All the sins affect other people in your circle.
And by the way, I've never had this thought. You just awakened this thought in me. That is the magic of Youth Station, guys.
Mm-hmm, yes. It just everything happens on the spot.
But you're right. In that sense, there really is no personal sin. If
yes.
anything, you're offending the angels who are sitting on your shoulders. You know,
yes,
they're
yes.
having to write this crap down, you know, because
yes.
of you. They want to be writing down good things.
Yes, they have to write mm-hmm. good things.
Yeah.
They expect us to let them write good things.
Yeah. Yeah, so you at the very least you're offended.
Why do
them.
We not learn from our mistakes? Why we do
I
them
told
again
you at the
and
beginning,
again
sister,
and again?
We are stupid. We're really unintellectual beings. Do you know, I've heard somewhere that the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and to, even if it fails. It's like running into a wall and then you hurt yourself and then you run into it again and again and again, hoping to get through the wall.
Isn't there any desire inside of us that pushes us into doing those mistakes?
Absolutely.
So it's something intuitively put into us.
Yes and no.
So it's a part of us.
Okay, so in Islamic philosophy, they talk about, or philosophy, akhlaq actually, so
yes.
that would be ethics, right? So they talk about the four faculties, which I'm sure you've heard of, right? The first is the intellect.
Yes.
Right? The second is the waham, the imagination.
Yeah.
The third is the faculty of anger. And the fourth is the faculty of shahwa, desire, right?
Yes.
Now, these four faculties are actually parts of our soul.
Yes.
Right? And at one point, you know, intellect will be governing what you do. At another point, anger will come into your mind and it will control what you do. Another time, you know, shahwa will come into your mind. And
so you must practice taqwa. That's the only way to control all of those faculties.
Yeah, and do you know how we define that? It's when the intellect is in control of the other three faculties.
That's very true.
So Imam Khomeini talks about the battle within. You know,
yes, the battle within.
You've read 40 hadith? It's worth reading parts
yes,
of it.
Yes, yes it is.
So the very first chapter, he talks about, you know, the whole hadith about the greater jihad?
Yes, jihad with yourself.
Exactly. And he says that it's really fascinating the way he describes it, because he says that there are kind of two armies which are coming to clash with each other. And
yes.
that's happening within you.
Yes, that happens.
So
within
one of the armies is the army of the intellect. Right. And it is fighting with the others, and the others, you know, you have the army of shahwa, of desire, of anger, and of the waham, imagination, and they're all
and
battling.
It depends on you which
yeah.
to be armed more.
Yeah, exactly. You have to ensure that the intellect takes control of your entire existence.
Yes, yes, that's very true.
This,
so
okay.
everything starts when the intellect is not working. And we give the control to all the other faculties
yeah.
that you already
yeah.
talked
so,
about.
So let's say, for example, you have a burger in front of you, right? You know that
yes.
this burger is bad for you. Or you know that this burger is haram. Your faculty of desire is going to tell you to eat that burger. But that's your intellect speaking, sister. Actually, if your shahwa was in control,
yes.
if they are, you would be like, this is food and it tastes good. That's it. I'm going to eat it. You see?
Maybe you're right.
Of course. That's what would happen. If the faculty of intelligence doesn't have
yes.
control, the shahwa will drive us to become asfala safilin.
Yes, that's
it. It will
true.
Make us the lowest of the low.
Yes.
And, you know, there are lots of people in the world today
We'd
who are.
We'd be like the beasts.
We would be worse than the beast, yeah.
Yes, like a real monster.
Absolutely worse than the beast. But that's what I really do feel like it comes down to. We, although we've been given intellect,
yes.
we don't act upon it.
Maybe we don't appreciate what we have. We don't give it a time to speak of its own right
mm-hmm.
and do whatever it has supposed to do. That's when we are doing those mistakes.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
There are certain mistakes that you might be making over and over
yes.
again. It's like I'm talking to you like a psychologist right now or like a psychiatrist.
yeah.
Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this insane behavior?
maybe giving... you are hoping that maybe something good would come out of it. You're still not done with that situation. You are hopeful. You think there might be some good results the way you have planned in your brain or mind. Mm-hmm. Maybe you still think there's something good coming out of that mistake that you're going to do on and on. You're still not done. Wow. You have not learned the lesson you have to learn. So you do that mistake again and again and again.
That's really sad, isn't it?
It is. Life is tragic.
Life is tragic.
Wow. Yes, life is very tragic.
That should be a quote.
Every single human being is a hero of their own story.
Youth Station, choo-choo-ca-choo, life is tragic. That's how we should start.
Yes.
Life is tragic. Get over it. Well, actually, we make it tragic, though, don't we? Because we just keep on committing those same mistakes.
Well,
and I think
we're like the fingerprints. Everyone is different. Mm. We are not. No way. There is no two people who are going to be the same, who are going to act like the same way. And that's the beauty of human beings, I think, because they're not like each other. Even their mistakes are not going to be like each other.
Yeah.
There's always innovation in doing those mistakes. Everyone does it in their own way.
Yeah. Okay, so then I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that you feel like there's still some benefit in it.
Yes.
And it goes back to the analogy, you know, you're just running into this wall, banging into the wall. You're not thinking of climbing over it or going around it or digging under it or anything. Just keep on banging
into it. And I just remembered something right now. Mm. You know, it's exactly the situation when we are asking God to forgive us about a sin we have done. He says that forgiveness is not given to you unless you are so sad with what have you done. Yeah. Unless you are totally regretful about what you have done. Only in that moment your sin is going to be forgiven.
Yeah.
Because you have come
Absolutely.
To the conclusion that there is no benefit in that. There is nothing good or no blessing coming out of that mistake you're doing.
Yeah, there's actually no benefit in it for me.
Yes, but you should come into that conclusion like a real
more accurately,
regression.
The benefits in that thing that I'm doing are way, way less than the detriment.
Yes.
Like it has way more harm than good.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so people fall into this pattern. You run into the wall, you hit your head, you get pain, you fall down, you get back up, you run into the wall again. And
yes.
It just goes on and on.
Like a circle.
How do you break that circle? How do you come out of that mind?
I told you, you must come to the conclusion that what I'm doing is wrong. Like a real, real conclusion. You have to come to this very point that, okay, I'm fed up with what I'm doing. That's enough. I have to take an action. I have to hang on, think, and act wisely. Stop doing the same thing that is harming me for a very long time. And start doing things in a way that is more satisfactory, that is going to make God happier with me.
Mm-hmm.
Always consider the fact that God is watching us. If we consider that, and based on our fitrat, I think we have to do the right things, and we all know what is the right thing, but we just don't give it a voice to speak louder.
We've only scratched the surface of the subject, but we've run out of time. From myself and from Sister Asma,
yes,
we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Have good days and nights.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.